Good morning and welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have three cases on our docket for oral submission this morning, and you all are the first. I understand you've checked in with our clerk and announced the time you would like to argue, and if you all are ready to proceed, I'll have the clerk call your case. Counsel's ready?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
Would you please call the case?
May it please the court.
Morning, counsel.
The trial court erred in granting the appellee special appearance for the following three reasons, which we will address in turn to this morning our submission. First, the evidence is insufficient to support the trial court's finding that it did not have specific jurisdiction over Chris Edens because he committed a tort in Texas. Second, the evidence is insufficient to support the trial court's finding that it did not have either general or specific jurisdiction as with regard to Mr. Cyphers. And third, the evidence is insufficient to support the trial court's finding that the exercise of jurisdiction in this case would offend the traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice. Turning to my first issue with regard to specific jurisdiction with respect to Mr. Edens, we believe this is not even a close call. The gravamen of our complaint was that SCD, through its principals, Mr. Edens and Mr. Cyphers, colluded and conspired with our business partner, Mr. Fleet, and we call them the Fleet defendants in our brief, to cut my clients out of 60% of their company. We pled and presented evidence that showed undisputedly that Mr. Edens was the point man for SCD. He handled the negotiation of the what we call the Mary Carter Agreement at issue. He discussed the lawsuit with Mr. Fleet. He negotiated with Mr. Fleet. And not only that, he actually came to Tarrant County and testified at trial to effectuate the desired outcome set forth in the Mary Carter Agreement. So we look at the test for specific jurisdiction. Does Mr. Edens' contacts with the state of Texas have a substantial connection with the operative facts of this lawsuit? And they do. It's undisputed that Mr. Edens came to Texas and helped effectuate that illegal Mary Carter Agreement, which was tortious in that it breached not only participated in a breach of fiduciary duty that Mr. Fleet owed to my clients, his business partners, and also tortiously interfered with their operating agreement. Now, the same result applies in, yes, sir?
Counsel, how is obtaining a judgment in favor of Biltmore a tort?
Well, the judgment itself is tainted. The Mary Carter Agreement called for SCD and the Fleet defendants to cooperate together and achieve that desired outcome.
Okay. SCD didn't get a judgment, did it?
Correct. And that's why the judgment's tainted. They also, in that judgment, they inserted conclusions of law.
SCD couldn't execute on that judgment, could it? Only Biltmore can execute on that judgment.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So how is obtaining, I'm back to my original question, how is obtaining a judgment, a tort in the state of Texas?
What's important about the judgment is that they inserted conclusions of law that Three Star defrauded SCD. SCD did not have a fraud claim pending. It only had a deck action pending. The judgment did not award SCD any damages whatsoever. But not coincidentally, after the judgment was entered, SCD went to North Carolina State Court and waived that fraud judgment and said, my guys are a part of a conspiracy with Three Star to defraud them, and Three Star's an adjudicated fraudster. They did the same thing in Houston. They said, my clients, other entities, they sued SCD in Houston. They said, your claims are barred by res judicata because you're in privity with Three Star, which was an adjudicated fraudster. So it goes beyond just getting the judgment where they didn't get any relief.
Okay, where is that in any of the briefing that we've had so far?
We put it set forth in our response to the special appearance. It was argued substantially. It's been an issue pretty much every hearing at the trial court level that they colluded and attained a judgment they could take and use collaterally other places without my clients being present in that case. Okay. And as for a specific jurisdiction for Mr. Cyphers, admittedly, the analysis is a little tougher. Mr. Cyphers was the one, he was the sole managing member of SCD. He's the one who approved and signed off on the Mary Carter Agreement. Without his execution and approval of the Mary Carter Agreement, it wouldn't have come into effect. So merely, far from just aiming a tort at Texas, Mr. Cypress reached into Texas, entered a contract with a Texas resident to resolve a Texas lawsuit that resulted in a Texas tainted judgment. So we think the court erred in finding it did not have specific jurisdiction as to with regard to Mr. Cypress and Mr. Edens. Turn to my next point, which is...
Okay.
Yes, sir.
You don't have a collateral attack on the judgment, do you? In other words, there's nothing in any of the pleadings that you've done that's asking for any type of collateral attack on the judgment. You keep referring to it as being a tainted judgment, okay? And your tort is caught up in this judgment. But there's absolutely nothing in the record, unless you want to tell me where it is, that actually says this is anything other than a final judgment, which is why they were able to use it elsewhere.
And it may not be in our live plea, and I will check before coming back for rebuttal. It's certainly in our current plea that we've asked for a deck action to set aside those findings of facts and conclusions of law with regard to the fraud findings for the reasons I explained. That we have pled that. Now, if it's in our live plea, I'm going to check during the break to see if it is, but I know we have pled that. Turning to general jurisdiction with regard to Mr. Cypress, the first issue is what is the proper standard of review? It's an issue this court, in Justice Walker's opinion in Moncrief, suggested that it was improper to apply the traditional standards of review when reviewing a cold record. The Supreme Court of Texas took that issue up. It was briefed and argued at the Supreme Court, but for whatever reason, they did not feel the need to address it in the subsequent Moncrief appeal. So that issue remains unresolved and open under Texas law.
Well, counsel, it seems like it remains rejected.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree with that. If the Texas Supreme Court had wanted to reject Parmalee or reject the analysis in this court's opinion in Moncrief or in Villa Gomez, they would have simply said so in Moncrief.
Well, if they had the opportunity to change the standard of review and they didn't, then my opinion in Moncrief has been basically rejected.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree with that. They did not address the issue because they didn't feel the need to do so because the jurisdictional facts, in their view, were undisputed. Therefore, if they had done so with undisputed jurisdictional facts, it would have been essentially an advisory opinion, which the Supreme Court would not render. So that issue they could have simply said in that footnote, we reject the Fourth Court of Appeals' concerns, the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals' concerns. But they did not. So that issue, our view, is still unresolved. Okay. And we're applying the de novo standard review in this case to Mr. Cypress. That means he had the burden of proof in this case after we pleaded our sufficient jurisdictional facts to negate all bases of jurisdiction. And the test we're advocating here is not a blanket de novo review for all cases where there's some conflict in the evidence. What we're advocating is if the special appearance hinges on a material fact issue, and that material fact issue requires the resolution of a witness's credibility, that witness needs to testify live in front of the trial judge so that the trial court can assess the credibility of that witness. Here, Mr. Cypress knew or certainly should have known that his credibility was an issue with regard to a material fact issue, that being his Texas contacts. And once we put that in issue, he should have came to testify live in front of the trial court to prove his case, to carry his burden of proof to negate all bases of jurisdiction.
Counsel, how are we to, in a de novo manner, assess the credibility of the witnesses in this case?
The court cannot, not on a cold record. Any assessment of credibility requires viewing the witness in front of you.
So you're not actually arguing for a de novo review. You're arguing that there was an abuse of discretion below in not assessing the credibility, by not making findings of fact and conclusions of law.
Respectfully, I disagree with that, Your Honor. I believe abuse of discretion would be even a higher standard than legal or factual sufficiency for us. But again, it wasn't our burden to ask for this.
No, it's a procedural point, counsel. If we can't assess credibility, we can't conduct de novo review. So finding that de novo review is the appropriate standard to apply in a case where applying the standard wouldn't reach a result seems to be counterfactual.
Well, hope I'm understanding what you're saying, but I believe a de novo review can apply based on the factual record with what we have in front of you, what we have in front of the court. And then since we pleaded sufficient jurisdictional facts, the burden shifted to Mr. Cyphers. And once he had this issue of his credibility, it was incumbent on him to carry his burden to bring live testimony that was credible and explain away any inconsistencies in his discovery responses or his affidavit. When he fails to do so, he didn't tip the scales. He didn't carry his burden. De novo review, if it's even, he loses on that issue because he had the burden of proof.
But determining whether or not he tips the scales or not is a determination of credibility. So, again, applying de novo review, how are we to do that? We don't. You basically just want us to disbelieve him, and we're not in a position to do that. We don't have fact-finding jurisdiction.
Correct.
So you essentially are asking, apply de novo review, and kick it back to the trial court to do something?
Well, I guess with regard to a remedy, there's two alternatives. One is reverse and say you didn't carry your special appearance burden. You're going back to the trial court for a decision on the merits. Alternatively, I guess you could reverse and remand for a live hearing, but I believe he's waived that by not asking for that and presenting the live testimony when it was his burden. But I don't even think you have to go to the de novo review. Even if you applied a traditional legal or factual sufficiency analysis, the result would be the same. The court would only imply judgments or findings in favor of the judgment if it was supported by the evidence in the record. And in this case, it's not. With regard to Mr. Cyphers' Texas-based contacts for general jurisdiction, we allege he was a managing member of a Capital Preservation Group, LLC, a Texas limited liability company. He has not disputed that in his affidavit. He's disputed it for the first time on appeal, but he did not negate that basis in his affidavit for the court. In fact, his reply brief to the special appearance said he forgot about his status as a member of Texas Capital Preservation Group. We presented evidence about his business relationships with an entity called Agilis Benefit Services of Texas. He did not negate that contact whatsoever. We also presented evidence about his business contacts with Agilis Benefit Services, LLC. He did try to dispute that by saying that wasn't me individually. It was my company, New Era Financial Planners. But the documentary evidence in the record discredits that and contradicts that story because the insurance policy receipts all have his name as the agent in his individual capacity. New Era is not mentioned anywhere on that. And to put the cherry on top of that, we asked him for documents that would show whether he or an entity under his control, which would include New Era, had contacts, agreements, contracts, agreements, purchase orders, or in documents that showed he had customers in Texas. He said none. So, and then to top it off, he says he forgot about his interest in Capital Preservation Group. His partners in Capital Preservation Group, or gentlemen by the name of Mr. Wright and Mr. Edwards, they were the principals in Agilis. And Mr. Cyphers and the Agilis entities were sued twice for multi-millions of dollars. So it's not credible, and I know it's not the court's determination whether that's credible, but frankly, it's not credible to say, I forgot about it. So looking at this factual record, what's in the record, the paper in the record, it discredits and contradicts his assertions that he had no Texas-based contacts to the extent that no reasonable juror would believe him. And if you apply the traditional factual sufficiency review, the evidence he presented, again, his burden of proof, the evidence he presented was so weak and contrary to the overwhelming weight of the evidence that the result that the trial court's decision say he didn't have general jurisdiction is unjust and clearly wrong. So any standard review you apply in this case gets the same result. Mr. Cyphers has sufficient contacts with the state of Texas. And in my final minute here, I want to address the traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice argument. That argument fails for three reasons. First, as the Texas Supreme Court has said, it's only a rare case where the exercise of jurisdiction would offend traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice. We cited the Spearstar case with all the German defendant. We cited the Guardian Royal Exchange case that involved an English defendant. If the exercise of jurisdiction over a German and English defendant did not offend traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice, I don't believe exercising jurisdiction over a Tennessee or North Carolina resident would do so. But there are two better reasons than that. First, Mr. Cyphers and Mr. Eanes will be witnesses at trial. Whether they're a named defendant or not, they will be in the Tarrant County Courthouse testifying in this case. There's no unresolving that. Mr. Eanes was the point man. Mr. Cyphers is the man in charge. They're going to be there. For the issues of judicial economy, it makes sense to have it all tried in one case as opposed to us trying a case against SED here and trying other cases in Tennessee or North Carolina where they live. But also, the third and perhaps most important is Texas courts have a special interest in adjudicating tort claims that are committed within their border and are committed against their residents. But the Texas courts also have an even higher interest, I believe, in making sure adjudicating claims that one of their state courts rendered a tainted judgment that was a product of collusion or an illegal Mary Carter agreement. If there are no other questions, I reserve
the right.
Counsel,
I have a question.
Sure.
Please elucidate for me your view of why this was a Mary Carter agreement.
Sure. It resolved litigation between the parties, competing claims. SED and Biltmore Funding Suit both asserted competing declaratory judgment claims to the same collateral. They resolved their dispute with the a settlement agreement. The agreement provided required SED to cooperate in the trial. We don't know the extent of the cooperation, what emails they shared, or what other communications they may have had to prove up their case. But there was cooperation, which I believe under disciplinary rule 304 or 308, you're not allowed to offer a witness anything in terms of compensation for their testimony at trial. So SED agreed to cooperate. They did come to cooperate, and they got a judgment.
And they kept was all of that disclosed to the court at the time of the judgment?
They just
the judgment. In other words, there wasn't in terms of the trial court's knowledge of the relationship between the parties. I didn't see how there could have been a sham of adversity in terms of we're really fighting each other, but we're not. In this case, there was full disclosure of the approach of the parties and the agreement they reached.
Well, 2 points on that. I don't know if there was full disclosure.
let me withdraw that. Yeah. There was disclosure and information and even evidence in the trial court that these two parties had agreed and cooperated and made an agreement.
I don't know if they disclosed that they had agreed to cooperate. I know I do concede they did disclose they had an agreement and they're going to agree to split the loans or split the proceeds. But more important than that, Your Honor, is at the jurisdictional stage, the Texas Supreme Court says we don't look at the merits of the parties' claims or defenses.
And I understand that. So thank you for your response.
Thank you, Your Honor. Any further questions? Thank you.
Would you please add 1 minute of time, appellees? You may proceed.
May it please the court, I want to make sure we're in the proper framework when discussing this and to highlight on some of the questions Justice Meyer and Justice Birdwell you asked. The trial in Tarrant County in the first lawsuit, as it's been called, occurred in June of 2016. And to your question, Justice Meyer, the agreement was fully disclosed. It was disclosed in both opening statements that SED and Biltmore II had resolved their differences. And the terms of that agreement were disclosed to Judge Davis during trial, that the agreement was that SED and Biltmore II would split the proceeds of the sale of the loans. And the parties were asking for the loans to be awarded to Biltmore II as a result of the outcome of the trial. And regarding these fraud allegations, when you look at the judgment, you can see that Judge Davis actually interlineated and made changes to the language in the judgment. And to your point about a sham of adversity, one of our key points below is in the absence of a jury, there's a question of whether you can have a Mary Carter agreement in the first place. And it's particularly a high hurdle when you consider that it was fully disclosed to the trial judge. And also important is the fact the defendant in that case, Three Star Properties, didn't object at all to the terms of this agreement or the existence of the agreement. It wasn't raised until September of 2016 when this underlying lawsuit was filed. And to your question earlier, Justice Birdwell, about, you know, is there a collateral attack on the judgment? On the pleadings before this court, on the special appearance appeal, there is a request that the settlement agreement between SED and Biltmore II be set aside. Counsel is correct that has morphed into the case, but as far as the record on appeal now, There is no request to set aside that judgment. I want to briefly start with discussing the standard of review, as I think it's crystal clear that there is no basis to depart from what is a well-established standard of review on cases like these. And Justice Walker, when appellants quote the intermediate or your opinion in the Moncrief case, they leave off the next paragraph. And that next paragraph where the court said, we conclude that although the special appearance hearing was not evidentiary, and despite our concerns, we must nonetheless defer to all implied findings of fact that support the trial court's grant of a special appearance. And the Supreme Court recognized that standard again, and it's been repeatedly. American Type Culture, BMC Software in 2002, Moki Mac, if that's how you say it, I'm not quite sure, 2007, the Kelly case in 2010, and as I said, Moncrief Oil in 2013. And trying to upend the standard of review based on a 1993 sanctions case where the standard's totally different just simply doesn't work. So we would submit the court should follow the standard of review and imply the findings that supported Judge Evans' factual determinations below. As to general jurisdiction, there's no argument as to Mr. Eden's, and the argument centers around Mr. Cyphers. Mr. Cyphers made a mistake. He messed up his first affidavit, no question. They called him on it, and they were right. And he corrected it in his subsequent affidavit. The law on the general jurisdiction question puts a very, very high burden on the party asserting it. There's a fairly recent case out of the U.S. Supreme Court, I think Daimler versus Baumann, said that essentially it must be so continuous and systematic that the defendant must be essentially at home in the forum. So Mr. Cyphers had an agreement through a company with a Texas entity, Agilis, that sold insurance products, not to Texas residents, not Texas insurance policies. And this occurred in the 2003 to 2006 timeframe. There were two lawsuits filed, one in Mississippi, one in North Carolina. So that's one isolated contact. Secondarily, you have this capital preservation group, a Texas entity formed in 2008. Mr. Cyphers was a manager member. I don't frankly think the distinction matters. Assume he was the manager or the sole member even. Nonetheless, he clarified in his affidavit that he forgot about it. But he did form it in 2008. It never did any business, and it forfeited its corporate charter in 2011. So you have a 2003 to 2006 little bucket of activity. You have the 2008 to 2011 existence of an LLC that did nothing and forfeited its charter. That's not continuous and systematic. That's random, isolated, and fortuitous, I guess, is some of the language that cases use. But you have these two instances. He's not essentially at home. Another thing the Supreme Court says is, well, let's construct a hypothetical claim, because general jurisdiction is supposed to be a dispute-blind inquiry. So take this case out of it and just hypothetically look at Cyphers and determine whether a hypothetical claim could exist against him and jurisdiction would suffice. He's done so nothing. You can't even construct a hypothetical claim, because he has no activity since 2011 when that entity forfeited its charter. If you assume that entity would have entered into contracts, the statute of limitations would have expired. And there's no evidence it did enter into any contracts. So Judge Evans resolved those factual disputes about that kind of conduct and those two corporate contacts in Mr. Cypher's favor, and that was the right decision. And by implying the factual findings as the court should, based on the standard review, the same results should be reached here, that there is no general jurisdiction as to Mr. Cypher's based on two stale, outdated, and unrelated contacts. It's simply not continuous and systematic as the cases require. So next is,
in other words, we can assume Mr. Cypher's was lying and still affirm.
Well, I think lying's a strong word, Your Honor.
Well, it's been used. So.
It has. He made a mistake, and we own that. We're not running from it. And he owned it in his subsequent affidavit. He said, I forgot about this. So you can assume his first affidavit was inaccurate because he admits it was.
My initial question is The discrepancy, shall we say, was brought to Judge Evans's attention, was it not?
It was, Your Honor.
Okay, and that was brought to his attention before he made his decision with regard to the special appearance?
That's correct, Your Honor. In the clerk's record is the notice of supplemental evidence that was filed before the special appearance hearing. That notice of supplemental evidence included a corrected affidavit of Mr. Cyphers, where he explains in detail, you know, when I initially answered discovery and when I submitted my first affidavit, I forgot about Capital Financial or Capital Preservation Group. And he also explains that the Agilis contact was not him individually. It was through a company, New Era Financial Planners.
Okay. And the portion of the temporary injunction that was quoted, the interaction between Judge Evans and Mr. Cyphers, you would agree makes it pretty clear that he was not very happy with Mr. Cyphers during that.
I would submit to the court that if the entirety of that transcript is viewed, Judge Evans wasn't real happy with anybody that
well,
day.
Well, I'm asking about that specific.
Yes, he construed Mr. Cyphers as being evasive to the answer of a question and chastised him for it, and that is an accurate quote of that exchange.
Okay, at the very least, this court understands that Judge Evans, in considering Mr. Cyphers' testimony, was aware of possible discrepancies and had to have taken those into account in making his decision on the special appearance.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So even if he thought Mr. Cyphers was not a particularly credible witness, we can infer that he took those matters into account in reaching his decision.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there any authority that says that we can come up with a credibility determination that's different than the one that the trial court makes?
I don't believe so. Not if the standard of review requires that you imply that Judge Evans made findings that support the judgment. So on to specific jurisdiction, there's a lot of allegations, but there's no where did these things happen? The only thing that happened in Texas is that Mr. Edens testified at the first trial. There's no allegation or evidence of anything else that he did in the state of Texas. With respect to Mr. Cyphers, the allegation is that he executed the settlement agreement that is characterized improperly as a Mary Carter agreement. There's no allegation that he did it in Texas or that he had meetings in Texas or that he directed activities toward Texas.
Why can we not infer that he directed? Did not SED intervene in the underlying lawsuit?
Correct, Your Honor.
And that would be intervening in a lawsuit in Texas as directed by the managing member?
It is the act of SED. The court clearly has jurisdiction over SED in this case, but the question has to be here, what did Mr. Cyphers do? If the appellants are right in this case, any time a member of an LLC executes an agreement that becomes the subject matter of an underlying lawsuit, the mere act of executing that agreement would submit that member to personal jurisdiction in Texas. That does away with a large body of corporate law that respects the individuality of the members versus the entities. There's got to be some more conduct. And if you look at the cases, there's a case out of this court that cited the Riata case. There were specific acts, specific meetings, conduct that was alleged to have occurred in Texas, more than just, well, he signed an agreement that became an issue. And there's a case, it is not cited by either party, but it was the Riata case is the one I'm speaking of out of this court in 2003. There's a case, American Airlines versus Luxury Travel Services, that references the Riata decision. And in that case, the court talks about the threshold that has to be met for an individual's conduct to submit both that individual and that in his company he is affiliated or she is affiliated with to personal jurisdiction. And there's no allegations and there's no evidence in the record that show anything more than Mr. Cyphers is a managing member of SED and he signed the agreement on SED's behalf. That's it. Edens.
What's the site on your case, counsel? Do you have it?
Yes, the luxury travel services case, Your Honor.
You said American Airlines was the
right. It is 276 Southwest 3rd, 154.
Thank you.
And would you like to cite the Riata case as well, Your Honor?
I know that one.
Very well. So did either Mr. is there evidence that either Mr. Cyphers or Mr. Edens purposely availed themselves of, you know, Texas jurisdiction? And there's not. The only conduct that is identified is conduct that was on behalf of SED. They weren't parties individually to the lawsuit. They didn't appear individually in the lawsuit. Mr. Edens testified as SED's corporate representative, just as Mr. Cyphers executed the agreement as the representative. So in the Supreme Court, I believe it was the Michiana case, said, you know, this notion of so-and-so directed a tort at Texas doesn't cut it. It doesn't get somebody there. And that's the same here. The mere fact that these individuals are alleged to have directed a tort at Texas doesn't meet the standard in this case. And if you look at another thing the cases say is you've got to go claim by claim. You can't just say, well, you know, a bare recitation of jurisdictional allegations suffices. And that's what you have here is a bare recitation. It's like someone took the long-arm statute and copied it and said, that's why we have jurisdiction. But in doing a claim-by-claim analysis, you can see the appellant's claim fails even further. If you look at the fraud by non-disclosure count, if you look at the aiding and abetting breaching of fiduciary duty count, and there is no allegation that any of that conduct occurred in the state of Texas by those individuals. It just simply says they did it. They committed breach of fiduciary duty or aiding and abetting. And that's all I have, Your Honor, barring any questions. Or Your Honors, excuse me.
Thank you, counsel.
Just a few points in rebuttal. First, as to the argument Mr. Cyphers and Mr. Edens can't be hailed into the Texas courts because they did everything in Tennessee or North Carolina, that's been disproven by the law. This isn't merely aiming a tort at Texas. They did something additionally to reach into the state of Texas. They look at the Burger King case of the U.S. Supreme Court. The defendant never set foot in Florida, but he had sufficient contacts to bring him from Michigan down to Florida. We've cited TV Azteca, Moki Mac. You direct somebody to go to Texas or you direct some conduct towards Texas in addition to aiming your tort, that is sufficient for jurisdiction. As for the individual capacity, we can't be held in for the acts of the LLC. We didn't sue Mr. Cyphers and Mr. Edens because SED breached the contract. We sued them because they committed torts in their capacity, either as individuals or as agents of SED. And all individuals are liable for their torts in whatever capacity, whether they're going to the supermarket to get milk or whether they're driving a truck for J.B. Hunt or some corporate entity. So that argument doesn't hold any water whatsoever. As to his assertion that he corrected his affidavit, there was a 65-day gap between us bringing that issue up and him correcting his discovery responses and filing a supplemental affidavit. But even that supplemental affidavit, I left off with talk about the general jurisdiction context. It's not any evidence of what happened with Capital Preservation Group. He equivocates his testimony in that affidavit by saying, to my knowledge, the company never did any business. To my knowledge, I didn't receive any income. To my knowledge, they're no longer in business. Such an equivocation is no evidence. That's legally insufficient. So he didn't meet any burden whatsoever. He has to show affirmatively that he has personal knowledge of those facts by saying, to my knowledge or to the best of my belief, that doesn't cut it under Texas law. And as for the stale contacts, This was a 2003. This was a 2006. Capital Preservation Group's 2008 to 12. It's not the quantity of the contacts that's relevant for jurisdiction. It's the quality. From 2003 to at least 2012, we know Mr. Cyphers had some business relationships with Texas-based entities and Texas-based individuals. Now, you talked about the two lawsuits. That's what Mr. Cyphers has told us.
Do we have any guidance with regard to stale? What constitutes stale? I mean, the events that you're complaining about all occurred 2-3 years later than the latest contact that's in the record with regard to Mr. Cyphers in Texas. So is 2 years sufficient to make it stale? Is 3 years sufficient to make it stale? Or if you have continuous contacts from 2001 to 2005, are you subject, and know you're subject to being hailed into court in Texas on something that's completely unrelated 10 to 15 years later?
We did address that in our reply brief, and there is some guidance that the answer is probably not going to be helpful. We cited the PHC Minn case, which cited Helicopteros from the U.S. Supreme Court, and we cited the American type culture cases, where in those cases say we assess contacts over a reasonable time period. Helicopteros was 7 years. American type culture, I believe they assess contacts over 20 years. So I guess the question is, what's a reasonable amount of time to assess Mr. Cyphers' contacts in this case? They haven't asserted any brief in our analysis as to what's in a reasonable time frame, and that was their burden of proof. But back to the two lawsuits, I mean, it would be a great coincidence that his only two agreements or arrangements with the Agilis entities both resulted in litigation. We asked for documents. We didn't get any. And I still, I know it's not on the record, but and probably don't care what my belief is, but I believe there are probably more contacts out there. But judging what he's set forth in his discovery, his conduct in this case, it's not credible. And to not call him out on it is to condone the conduct, in my opinion, respectfully.
What did you do in the trial court to bring this to Judge Evans's attention with regard to obtaining some type of remedy for failing to answer jurisdictional discovery?
We filed a motion to compel. They voluntarily withdrew their objections and say, this is all we have. Okay. What if they don't have any documents, they tell the court they don't have any documents, they don't have any further information, how can you make them compel something they claim not to have?
How can you produce something that you don't have?
Yeah. But, again, I don't think that's a credible explanation. And if there are no further questions, we ask that you reverse and remand. Thank you.
Thank you. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your arguments here today. Your case is submitted, and you are free to go about your business. The court will remain on the bench while the next case for oral submission moves forward.